This is Gary Taub, January 5th, 2003. Taoism.
Well, first of all, Eberhard, thank you for that gracious introduction. I really appreciate it. Appreciated our long relationship and history together, and hope it continues. I'm happy to be here and see you again. I also want to thank the Jung Society here for the gracious invitation to come and speak on this topic to this group. It's a topic, as I'll be telling you, it's dear to my heart and very personal, actually, and something I've been involved with and interested in for over two decades. So it's a blessing to be able to come to another city. I've shared my ideas and some of this material around Colorado and in a few other locations, but it's nice to have another chance to do that. So I'm glad to be here. Is there a glass that I can drink this water with? I mean, water is one of the Taoist favorite images, but this is more than I can deal with. What I plan to do most of this evening is present slides to you and talk to you about the slides. Most of these slides I made myself back in the days when there was not any other technology that we now have. So I will apologize if some of them may not be as good as could be done now with the newer technology. But I'll try and get through as many slides as I can because I really like them and I like what they show you. But by way of introduction, I just wanted to tell you something a little more personal. My connection with Taoism really came out of the unconscious itself, I feel. When I began doing my own analytic work now over 25 years ago, I would say I had many dreams over the years that were basically in alignment with Taoist principles, Taoist teachings, Taoist values. I'm not saying I had dreams about Chinese men running around, although later I did have certain dreams where a Taoist sage would appear, apparently after I built a stronger relationship with this tradition. But I did have dreams that, since my own analyst was familiar with Taoism, and he had worked with a couple of other analysts you may know of, Arnie Mandel, and of course Marie-Louise von Franz, both were interested in Taoism. And Jung himself had an interest in Taoism. So what my analyst was able to do to me is when I would have some of these dreams such as dreams that were adamant that I should not tamper with nature, not just nature outside, but that I should not tamper with my own nature too much, or disasters would occur, my dreams would usually say, or dreams that were continually encouraging me to live spontaneously, to live in the moment, to follow my impulses, dreams that emphasized that I should live in harmony and balance, even in very personal imagery sometimes, like one of the earliest dreams I had when I started analysis was that a young boy was going to teach me how to ride a skateboard. And I, of course, could not ride a skateboard for the life of me. And I think my analyst asked me, you know, what I thought it would take to ride a skateboard. And I said, incredible balance. He said, well, you're going to have to learn that. Dreams that said I had to learn how to ride on the wind or fly blind. Dreams that said that I should be like wood. Dreams that I was made out of wood in a wood world. Very bizarre dreams. Dreams that I should learn how to be like water. Well, all these dreams themselves are not specifically Taoist, but they all could be amplified and compared to Taoist teachings and Taoist images. And so every time as I got so excited, I'd go in for my analytic hour, I'd bring in a dream that I had no idea what it could possibly mean. And my analyst, in discussion with me, would help me crack it open a bit. And he'd say, oh, yes, you had this dream about this useless old man who really was wonderful. You know, that's just like there's so many Taoist tales about these useless old men and retarded men, and they are the ones who are living in accord with the Tao. And I went, really? So I'd run home and I'd read these books because I wanted to find out for myself what the Taoists were saying about these sort of images. And so over time, I started to really love the Taoist teachings, the Taoist stories, the Taoist images. And so I had built up kind of a knowledge base in this area. There really weren't too many analysts who really had studied this very deeply. So I ended up choosing that to be my thesis for my Jungian diploma, and then have continued to study it and actually put this presentation together later after this. But I wanted to say that because really it's not just a scholarly study of Taoism that I'm presenting to you, but this is my understanding of Taoism and how it fits Jungian psychology and how it could be a practical guiding image. I felt it helped to have Jung, who I love Jungian psychology, but then I had Taoism as another set of images and concepts that fit but was a little different. So it added another dimension to the relationship with the unconscious. The last thing I want to say before I go into the slides themselves is just to share with you a dream that I had while I was writing all this material, because I think it's a profound dream, and it's also a humbling dream. And I think it supported the work I was doing and also cautioned me about the limitations of it. The essence of this dream, just the central image of it, is that I was with a group of scientists, and we were in an observatory, and we had a huge telescope looking out into the cosmos. And we were all working together on this grand project that we were going to map the mystery of the cosmos. As far as I'm concerned, we were trying to map the Tao. And so we had a little whole arrangement. So one person would look through the telescope and they would tell the person what they saw. And these other people were around a big table and were drawing what was being described. And I was involved in this project somehow too. So in the dream, it was quite clear as we were getting information from the telescope that it's a very lovely dream for a Jungian, because the picture that was coming out was a mandala. Beautiful, intricate design. Immeasurable in its beauty. However, the lysis of the dream was that we all realized something to our dismay, that every single time that we had seen what was out there and we had drawn it, it had changed. And so everything we drew was wrong. It was all a little off. But that's exactly what we're dealing with now. That's why, Lao Tzu, the very first verse in Lao Tzu, he says that the Tao that can be told is not the true Tao. And I think the same thing could be said about the unconscious. Everything we say about the unconscious is an attempt to understand the unknown. You know, that's a paradox, because we have to admit it's a mystery. But even Lao Tzu felt like, even though the Tao was mysterious and couldn't really be known or named, he did write a number of verses himself trying to describe it and to give images of it. And that's pretty much the same spirit of what I'm trying to do too, is share some images and some ideas that I have about the nature of Taoism and the Tao. Okay, let's see. We're going to do the lights. Taoism is considered to be one of, let me get that a little better. I don't think it works the other way. I can make it go more out of focus, but yeah. Okay. Taoism is generally considered to be one of the three major religions in China, the other two being Buddhism and Confucianism. The roots of Taoism are considered to be 5,000 plus years old. And it's considered by scholars to have influenced just about every aspect of Chinese life, such as art, culture, philosophy, medicine, government. However, the more I studied Taoism, I learned quite quickly that Taoism is far from being any kind of an organized religion like we have here in the West or some of the other religions in the East. It really is a loosely associated set of practices, often quite diverse. For example, there were Taoist alchemists who were actually practicing alchemy in laboratories. There are Taoist yogic practices, breathing practices with goals of along those lines, meditation practices. There's a form of Taoist sexual yoga, somewhat like I imagine tantric yoga. And my favorite, there are cults of wine and ecstasy that were considered another Taoist practice, what I could find about it, those groups sound like early forms of hippies who went out in the forest and got drunk and wrote poems and sang music and stuff. What I'm actually going to be talking about today is considered philosophical Taoism. And it consists primarily of the teachings of Lao Tzu, and I'm not pronouncing these names right, by the way. Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu. And so this particular pictures a 17th century bronze statue. That's a depiction of Lao Tzu, who's generally considered to be the founder or originator of philosophical Taoism. He's portrayed there holding a scroll and he's riding a water buffalo. And you've probably seen, in fact, I saw one today walking down the streets down here by the university district, little oriental shop, and there was a little statue just like that. Because that's a famous picture from the legend of Lao Tzu. And what it refers to is the story of how he wrote the Tao Te Ching. According to the legend, towards the end of his life, Lao Tzu was saddened by the fact that his teachings had not been integrated into the general populace. Excuse me. So he finally decided to. He decided to spend the end of his life or the rest of his life in solitude. So it's said that he mounted this water buffalo and headed out to the west in the direction of Tibet. At Hongkou Pass, which I guess was perhaps the last pass of civilization before he would be just leaving into the wilderness, The story is that there was a gatekeeper who asked him if he wouldn't turn back. That he had such great teachings. Wouldn't he come back and continue to teach? And he said he would not. However, the gatekeeper persuaded him to write down his teachings. And it said that he retired for 3 days and returned with a slim volume of 81 verses called the Tao Te Ching, which translated means the way, the Tao, or the way and its virtue or power. And I think I can safely say it's one of the most well disseminated and translated philosophical pieces that exists. Now, just to sort of place how I was thinking about Taoism, to me, philosophical Taoism was a result of a universal and age-old pursuit of human beings, which is to wonder about and attempt to understand what the nature of the universe is, particularly what we can't see, what isn't obvious on the surface, so that, you know, we've had many religions and philosophers and theologians and scientists and all kinds of metaphysical practitioners and psychologists such as Jung try to look past the veil into the mysterious forces operating in the universe. And even so-called primitive peoples explain their world by unseen forces and energies and are probably much more aware of those than we are today. Most, if not all, religious and metaphysical theories believe in some sort of universal or creative energy or force or intelligence that's permeating the universe and hidden from our everyday senses. It may or may not be personified, as you know, as a god or a goddess. It's interesting, in Taoism, it's generally not personified. It's just called the Tao. However, in actual practice, many of the Chinese or Taoists did personify the book, the I Ching, which is said to help give us an inkling of what the Tao is. So they saw the I Ching as an oracle. But whether personified or not, there appears to be a consensus that the universal energy or intelligence, though beyond our comprehension, can in fact be experienced, and that our relationship with it is important, of the utmost importance in terms of our spiritual well-being. One of the things that you find out right away if you study Taoism is that in contrast to most spiritual teachings that are based on a doctrine or a spiritual revelation, divine revelation, the ancient Chinese philosophy of Taoism is based on the observation of nature. So over thousands of years, the forerunners of Taoism came to put down what they thought were the important patterns of change and transformation. It's one of the tie-ins with Jungian work, is that we're interested in change and transformation, and that's what the Taoists were interested in as well. The most widely known and available collection of these observations of the nature of change became known as the I Ching, or the Book of Changes, which is thought to be over 3,000 years old. Now, the observations in the I Ching are organized into 64 basic images or patterns called hexagrams. But even more basic than the hexagrams, each of the hexagrams is actually made up of what are called trigrams. And there are eight basic trigrams or images, or we would say in Jungian thought, archetypes. So the Chinese identify eight basic archetypes that they feel are involved in the process of change. Again, as I've told you, most of these images are connected with nature. So each of the eight trigrams is actually a nature symbol. And they are, as they're depicted in this picture, heaven, earth, water, mountain, lake, sun, or fire, thunder, and wood, or wind. I understand each of these images as representing a basic form of energy that's observed in nature, but from my psychological perspective, I understand them each psychologically as representing a certain state of consciousness. So each of the trigrams can be equated with a distinct temperament, or emotional field, or a mood, or a state of mind, or even a behavior that could be correlated with them. Now, from the Taoist point of view, the reason this is all important is because they felt at any given point in time, certain ones of these would be appropriate. They would be, the Tao for the moment would be centered on a certain trigram or two trigrams in the I Ching. And the whole point of Taoism is to be in accord with the Tao. So it would be important to know what was manifesting in the Tao so that you could be in accord with it. That you would align yourself with the state that was the Tao for that point in time. So then you would be in Tao if you were in accord with what was manifesting at a certain point in time. And if you're not, you're not in Tao. So I'm going to run through each of them real quickly because I want to get on to some other ideas. But as I run through these, just think of them as these. I'm describing states of being or potentialities in yourself which would be appropriate at a certain point in time and not appropriate at another, depending on what the Tao was. Another thing I suggest to people when I talk about this is that you probably have dreams about all these images. That's another way, you know, in our Jungian work we use dreams a lot. And so the dreams that might reflect the Tao of heaven, the Tao of the lake, or the fire might be showing up in your dreams all the time. And you might want to think about them a little differently if you think about them in terms of Taoism. The Tao of heaven, or the trigram of heaven for the Chinese, represents the creative force of the universe. When it's positive, they felt like it would appear as strength, firmness, and creativity. It could also be out of balance and manifest more negatively as force or aggression or arbitrariness. The trigram Earth, which is also called the receptive, would psychologically express qualities such as receptivity, passivity, yielding, flexibility, submission, obedience. But it also can be out of balance, and in other words, be more in the form of a complex, in which case it might manifest as weakness or dependency or slavishness. This is the trigram thunder, or it's also called the arousing. It's associated with divine power, and especially forces. It's kind of a funny image because I'm showing lightning coming down, but they also imagined that it was also the force in spring that was pushing up real violently of new life, the new life breaking through the earth's surface. But it's more this arousing, powerful energy that suddenly appears. Psychologically, this would be the process of some inner stirring, rapid awakening, rapid growth, big breakthrough. And almost the opposite of that would be the trigram wind or wood. It's also called the gentle. And this trigram is showing the Taoist awareness that there's another kind of growth energy that's very slow and persevering and penetrating and gentle, but very powerful, like the wind. Like they said, give the wind enough time and it can remove a whole mountain. That was the idea, or the roots of a tree that could slowly push through the most solid rock. The symbol of the mountain is a trigram. It's also called keeping still. For the Chinese, the mountain they saw as something that stood fast and reached into the heavens. They felt it was suggestive of meditation, particularly a kind of meditation that reaches for higher states or spiritual heights. Another archetype would be the trigram, the lake. It has various meanings. Like the mountain, the Chinese Taoists saw the lake as still and quiet. However, they also recognized that there was something unseen in the depth underneath the lake. We would call the unconscious. So the lake can be a place where we're open and receptive to deeper inner experiences through quietude, some sort of inner work. Fire, or the sun, expressed qualities to the Chinese of brightness, light, dryness. psychologically, this could point to qualities such as consciousness, clarity, understanding, or illumination. And lastly, there you have the trigram water. Water usually refers to the dynamic, invigorating, enervating, ever-moving quality of water, as opposed to the lake, for example, the ocean. This is more like water that's flowing in a stream or a waterfall. And so it referred to the Tao of action, of movement, of hard work, and of doing. Yet, we'll get more into the yin and yang aspects, but water for the Chinese also was a very yin, had a very yin quality too, that it was also calming, receptive, and they felt it resembled a mother as a source of life. Now these eight trigrams that I've been talking about in the I Ching can also be arranged by seasons, which this is a diagram of. And I'm not going to go into that in detail, but I just wanted to show you that because it represents a basic observation that the Taoists made, which is about change, that change occurs in cyclic patterns, and that everything eventually turns into its opposite. Now, that's a direct parallel to something Jung discovered and teaches through observation of the psyche, that the psyche itself moves in a cyclic pattern, and that if we study the images and the flow of libido in the unconscious, that it eventually everything turns to its opposite as well, which is what he called enantiodromia. Recognizing this has some important practical implications, because I think most of us, starting with myself and most of the people I know and my clients, try to live our lives in a much more consistent, linear fashion than what the Taoists are talking about. There's various ways we try to do that. We like our routines. We like to sort of achieve goals and have the stability of a certain order in our lives. And I know people who just have a certain lifestyle who, for example, maybe work hard. They're hard workers, and they work hard all the time, most of the time. Or there's people who don't like to work hard, and so they are always goofing around and taking it easy. Well, according to the Taoists, both of these, you could not live in accord with the Tao if you had a way of living that was predictable or linear in that way. Because they're saying that the only way you can be in harmony with the Tao is you would have to change with the Tao changing, and that the Tao is constantly changing, and it's changing in cycles. So according to the Taoists, there would be a time for each thing. There would be a time to work, a Tao for work, there would be a Tao for play, a Tao to think, time to think, a time to feel more, a time to be more introverted, a time to be more extroverted. And that would depend on you perceiving what was being called forth or needed at a given point in time. When I first started analysis, and I was so excited about my dreams, and every time I'd go and I learned something tremendous about myself and a different way I could live. And I really cracked my analyst up after about a couple of months in analysis. I came in and I had formed a list of all the principles of which I would live now. And they were all from my dreams. It was good stuff. You know, one, I was going to do this. Two, I was going to do this. Three, they were really good things. And I said, look what I've done. I've created this list of all these rules for myself that are, and he told me to rip it up. Because you can't, it's not about a list. It's not about I was substituting new laws for my old laws, and he was saying, forget it, you just have to be in touch with the unconscious. Whatever that was, I didn't know at the time, but. Okay, you're all familiar with this image, and it's a central Taoist image. The other observation made by the Chinese about change was that change occurred through the interaction of opposites. or opposing energies. So this is one of the most common ways it's depicted, as showing the dark and the light interacting, or the yin and the yang interacting. The yang energy, being the light energy, was considered to be more masculine or active, and it was symbolized originally by the sunny side of a mountain. It's one of the oldest images of what yang is. And yin was the shady side of the mountain, or the more receptive principle, sometimes considered to be more feminine principle. Now, we're all familiar with this, but there's some more creative, and I think more interesting images in like, this is actually depicting the same thing in a much more artistic and creative way. So the fire is the red yang energy, and the clouds is the yin energy. So again, we see the combination of yin and yang uniting in a an energetic way. Also, it could be personified. So this painting, 17th century silk painting, showing the sexual union of a man and a woman, is actually meant to be symbolizing the union of opposites, yang and yin. The tree in the background is also marked with holes shaped to represent the character for union or harmony. Of course, the same idea, you know, we find in other traditions such as in alchemy, same idea of the union of masculine and feminine, or here king and queen, the sun and the moon. Jung seems to have emphasized exactly the same principle as the Taoists in saying that in order to become whole, we have to take on the difficult task of uniting and integrating the opposites in our psyche. And yes, sometimes actually in actual relationships we have to try and do it. It's also very difficult to do it there. The opposites I have found in all my years of practice, you know, it's different for everybody. I can't predict ahead of time what they'll be, but everyone has opposites that are split and that they have to unite to be whole. For one person, it could be a split between being strong and being weak. Another person, it could be a split between pride and humility. But whatever opposites we're speaking of, the Taoists and Jung both believe that it's through uniting the opposites that we can live in harmony or in the Tao. This is showing another Taoist principle, which is that change does not occur by chance, nor by a more mechanistic model that we sometimes have in the West of cause and effect. For the Chinese, the change occurs more organically, because for the Chinese, the seed of the future is already present, in the present. The seed of the future is in the present. And that's why this picture I put up, particularly because of that, those two black dots or the eyes in the yin-yang symbol are the seeds of the opposite. For each of them are the seeds of what's to come from the other side. I think that's really relevant to Jungian work, because often the seeds of what is wanting to come or develop in our psyche or in our lives is present in the unconscious much long before it's ever conscious. That's one of the reasons we can use dreams, I think, to facilitate the process of growth and development, because things start showing up in the dreams before we're aware of them, things that need to start being more conscious. So those little seeds of the future are actually in our dreams, if you look at them that way. And other signals from the unconscious as well, not just dreams, of course. This is one of my favorite pictures. The Taoists were fond of trying to depict the Tao. Like, what would it look like if you could draw it? So this is one artist's image of what the Tao looks like. I think it's important because a lot of people, when they think of Taoism or they think of meditation, you think of some sort of real passive, quiet state where you're going to be real centered and in some sort of ideal state of balance. Well, if you would live in accord with the Tao, according to this artist, you would look like that. Pretty scrambled up in a way. This is also a projective test so that people see all the... I don't know about that, actually. It may be, because the Tao is considered to be free of the opposites and yet contain the opposites. So they may show up that way. So if the interplay of cosmic forces, that's the Tao, is ever changing and moving like this, this is my challenge to you all. Can you live like that? One person in an audience asked me, how could you be married if you could have, if you had like, we're living like that? It'd be pretty wild. Yeah. Let's see if I have the, it's an ancient picture, but I don't know, Well, many of these are actually from a book called The Tao. I think it's on the list. This is another interpretation. That's another interpretation. All right, that's one that's more tightly coiled, but it's basically the same idea that, and I feel the challenge is, can we follow the Tao? Can we really live our lives with enough fluidity and flexibility to really make adjustments? And I've come to believe some of the dreams people have with flying saucers are trying to get at that, because flying saucers can, I imagine that flying saucers, not working. Okay, can't do it. Oh, wait. I mean, I imagine a flying saucer could fly like that. So if you have a dream about a flying saucer, it may be, you could take it as a symbol of the Tao or being able to live according to the Tao. What I see more commonly in practice is people are learning, well, like I was learning how to ride a skateboard, and some of my clients, because I'm in Colorado, but they, a lot of people have dreams about skiing or and ice skating and things like that. But I think those are modern day images that are attempting to get at some notion of living life in a more fluid, balanced and movement-oriented way. Okay, this other slightly. So this is actually a three-dimensional picture of the same thing. This is a 2,000-year-old bronze hill jar from 200 BC. And so the inlaid gold on it is an attempt to show the lines of change, the flow of the Tao. It's a what? Incense plant? Okay. The Taoists also were fond of collecting objects or making objects that showed the various images. This is a... they collected marbled rocks. This actually is a dish. So this is a pottery object that was made, but it's to show the flow of the vital energy of the Tao. The other favorite Chinese symbol for the Tao is the dragon. Dragon characterizes the Tao as a creative force, or dynamic universal force. And then there are these pictures that show the dragons flying or flowing along currents or waves. And so they're meant to show, they're called the lines of change, and they're also called dragon lines or dragon veins. Again, there's this idea that there's some sort of a current or flow of energy or meaning that has a certain course. And that leads us to another image of riding on the wind. So the Taoists thought that the sage, the one who attempts to live in accord with the Tao, could ride on the wind. or could be carried by the flow of the Tao. So Chuang Tzu, for example, writes, it's easy to stand still. The difficulty is to walk without touching the ground. Now, there's actually two meanings, typical ways that scholars have taken this, what that means. One is that it's actually referring to a mystical Taoist practice of meditation. So floating on the wind is actually going into a meditative or visionary state. In Jungian work, it would be something like perhaps a practice of meditation or active imagination, where we try to connect with the deeper unconscious. However, I also am interested in riding the wind as an image referring to the principle of Wu Wei, which translated means effortless action. It's one of the more important concepts in Taoism. What they mean by that is that you can act in a way that is forced, contrived, or artificial. Or you can act in a way that is in accord with the Tao. If you act in a way that's in accord with the Tao, then it is not, it's effortless action. It's carried by the Tao, so you don't have to do it with the ego so much. It'd be in Jungian language that the self, the energy from the self, moves the psyche in a certain direction, and you're trying to flow with that. Then you're living in accord with the Tao, and your action is not so effortful from the ego's perspective. But if the action is strictly out of the ego, particularly if it's not in alignment with the self, it for them would be way, this contrived or artificial action. At least that's my interpretation of it. So again, the idea of riding the wind would be the idea of being centered in the Tao and flowing back and forth. So again, we see this back and forth movement. So we're not looking for a static state. We're looking for a kind of flowing. Even the idea of being balanced or centered in Taoism doesn't make sense. It's not like you're in the center. The center is moving, or you're moving around the center, if you will. Let me read you what Chuang Tzu says about that. He says, halfway between the opposites, though it might seem to be a very good place, really isn't. You'll never get away from trouble there. It would be very different, though, if you were to climb up on the Tao, like that, and go drifting and wandering, neither praised nor damned, now a dragon, now a snake, shifting with the times, never willing to hold on to one course only. So that leads us to the next important Taoist image, and that is that the Tao is considered to be a path that you can travel on. And I found a lot of meaning in researching this is the oldest ideograph or character in Chinese for the concept of Tao, or the image of Tao. And there's three parts to this image. Essentially, there's a few interpretations I'll go over in a minute, but this is a road. Everyone agrees that this is a road. And that this is a head. And this is a foot. Everyone agrees with that much. So we have a road, a human head with some hair on it, and a human foot. All right, so what does that suggest to us? Well, the easiest thing to say is, okay, so they're saying that the Tao is something like a path that you can walk on and you could travel on. It's a way. It's a way to move through life. Jean Bolin does a little work with this, and she suggests that the head would represent heaven or the sun or the masculine or yang energy, and the foot represents the earth or the feminine or yin energy. So she suggests the character would show a path of wholeness, of uniting the yang and the yin, the head and the foot. Philosopher Alan Watts worked with this image a bit. He suggests that the head meant a kind of intelligence, but not rational intelligence, something of a higher nature, superpersonal intelligence or wisdom. And he felt the foot did mean walking, but a certain kind of walking, a rhythmic walking, a walking and pausing, a walking and pausing, going and pausing, which he felt, and which the Taoists do talk about, that if you're going to listen to the Tao, you have to keep pausing. You can take a step, but then you have to listen again to the Tao, because the Tao could shift, and you might have to shift your direction a little bit. So you can't run fast if you want to listen to the Tao. In fact, there's a warning in the I Ching that the young fox goes running across the ice field and gets its tail wet, meaning it falls in the ice. The old fox walks warily on the ice, listening for the cracks. It's listening for the Tao. You have to go a little slower if you want to be conscious. Jung actually did comment on this, too. Jung said the head symbolized consciousness, and... Well, that's all he said. The head, and he thought that suggested that it meant a pupil following a master. However, I would look at that more psychologically, if that's true, and say, well, I think that would mean the ego following a higher guiding principle. Perhaps you could say following the way of the self. Well, I guess here I just want to sum up. I mean, what I've been saying, if you're listening and you know basic Jungian psychology and the idea of individuation, everything I've been saying ties Taoism and individuation very closely together, because individuation, as defined in Jungian work, is a path of wholeness, a path of uniting the opposites, a process of living consciously, a path with meaning, or a process of uniting the ego and the self, or the ego trying to live in accord with the self being the guiding force. Lao Tzu, in verse 53, says, "If I have even a little sense, I will walk on the main road." Well, there's all these translations of Tao. So Tao here is capital M, capital R, main road. So if I have even just a little sense, I will walk on the Tao, or the main road, and my only fear will be of straying from it. However, there are other paths we can go on. I don't think most people's path is the path the Taoists were talking about. And Jung stresses that as well, that it's so important for us to differentiate out our individual path from the collective path that is so much the way of the masses, and there's so much pressure and coercion to follow the collective road. The collective path often seems safer, and, like I say, is powerfully persuasive. And I think there are many, many layers and levels of ways that we are unconscious of how much we are conforming to the collective, even when we don't think we are. Yolanda Jacobi, a student of Jung's, writes, "All too many people do not live their own lives, and generally they know nothing or next to nothing about their real nature. They make convulsive efforts to adapt, not to stand out in any way, to do exactly what the opinions, rules, regulations, and habits of the environment demand as being right. They are slaves of what people think, what people do, etc." And I think it's only fair to say those people who actually intentionally and dramatically try not to conform are not really living their own lives either. They're just acting out in the opposite direction. They're not in touch with the Tao necessarily at all. So the path that the Taoists speak of, I think, would be much narrower and rougher and more unique to each of us. Narrower, less traveled, expressing our uniqueness. And some people's paths may take them far, far away from the collective path to ways of living and experiencing life that have little in common with collective life, with the masses. You know, and I see that, and I try to support and encourage my own clients living their own way. It's very difficult, very hard. Many people cannot do it. For an example, I thought of two people who were doing it. One of my clients and his girlfriend had decided to get married, but they also had decided not to live together. They liked living in their own apartments. Everyone else thought it was pathological, odd, to say the least, not acceptable. But they felt like it was the right thing for them. And so in that sense, they were living a Tao that's was quite unique and out of accord with the conventional lifestyle. I've had other clients who have successfully made shifts, dramatic shifts, to take a different route. I've had people who come in to see me who were highly successful, wealthy businessmen. Well, one person who completely gave that life up to, well, right now he's in a, living in a monastery in Ireland. And I've had other people have to give up professional lives because what was called for was something else, like to be a musician, to find their own way in that. And there are many examples, and I'm sure many of you in this room are examples of this. And I think the more unique your path is, the more individual you are, it can be fairly lonely. It's something we have to deal with along the way, a certain amount of solitude. But I've always felt like gatherings like this help, that at least to know there are other people who are pursuing the same thing, and that you have fellow travelers, even if you're not exactly on the same path. I had a dream about that once. In fact, one of my favorite dreams of my life, where there were a group of us and we were all trying to do the same thing, like develop consciousness. And we were trying not to stand out too much in the world. We were just trying to find our own niche. And every so often, we recognized each other. And every so often, one of us would get in trouble. And then we would have to help each other out a bit. I had a really nice feeling about it. I think maybe what I'll do, this might be a good spot to take our little, we're going to take a brief break, 10 minute break. Okay, let's do that, and then I'll come back and show you some more Taoist images and ideas. We were just talking about roads, and the Tao is a road, and travelers on the road. And as you all know, one such traveler that we all are interested in have in common is not that person, but it's that person. and of course, Jung, early in his work, was interested in pathology and psychological disturbances, particularly caused by complexes in his early studies and the word association and so forth. But certainly in Jung's later work, that's the word association. In Jung's later work, he became more and more interested in the mystical dimension and the prospective dimension of the psyche. You know, like the Chinese, Jung felt we could align ourselves with these unseen forces of the unconscious, and that in some way, through doing that, we could learn and know, or at least know better who we are and know what direction our lives need to take to grow and to experience and to develop our fullest potential. Jung called this path the path of individuation. For Jung, dreams were one of the key ways to access a source of wisdom, and he acknowledges, and he, of course, acknowledged other ways as well, including meditation, active imagination, the use of intuition, and synchronicity. Sounding very much like a Taoist, Jung writes in Volume 6 of The Collected Works, there can positively be no higher principle than harmony with natural laws that guide the libido in the direction of life's optimum. This is a 16th century sacrificial bull. It represents another image of the Tao, a lesser known one, but this one is showing that actually there are three aspects of the Tao, according to the Taoists, that you could discern three different kinds of Tao: the Tao of heaven, the Tao of earth, and the Tao of the human being. Psychologically, we could take this to mean that there are three forms or channels through which we can experience the energy and the intelligence of the Tao or of the unconscious. The Tao of heaven, in this threefold scenario, would represent the celestial realm of spirit or essence. In his commentary on the I Ching, sinologist Richard Wilhelm speculates that the Tao of heaven refers to the invisible world of images, ideas, and archetypes. While it's debatable whether we can ever actually perceive this realm directly, I think we can all catch glimpses of it all the time. In my view, the Tao of heaven expresses itself in our dreams, in our visions, in our intuitions, in spiritual revelations, or other extrasensory and psychic experiences. The Tao of Earth refers to the thonic realm of matter and substance. As divine life that's indwelling in space and time, the Tao of Earth is the pattern of events in the physical world, or the rhythmic course of nature. Chuang Tzu says, "The influence of spring quickens the life of plants, and autumn brings them to maturity. In the absence of any agent, how is this so? It is the operation of Tao." So psychologically speaking, if we're going to live in accord with the Tao of Earth, we would have to live in harmony with the planet and with all of nature. Likewise, we would have to respect and harmonize with our own instincts, our own instinctive nature, with our own physical body. In fact, the more we pay attention to the physical environment in our bodies, we might discover that the unconscious expresses itself there too, in the form of synchronistic events, bodily symptoms that are symbolic, and various bodily sensations that are meaningful. I've done a lot of studying with Arnie Mendel, and that's been the center of that sort of work, is that you could focus on all kinds of moment-to-moment bodily phenomena, and not to mention symptoms, and get at the same unconscious material and symbols as you do in your dreams. And I've used that with a lot of clients where we take a headache or some physical symptom and investigate it very closely using some special tools and techniques and find out there's an important message in that headache, not something to just make go away. The Tao of the human being refers to Tao's expression in human existence, or conscious life. That is to say, the Tao flows not only through heaven and earth, but through us as well. However, unlike my picture here, the Tao of the human being for the Taoist does not refer to just any kind of human existence, but we would refer to the existence of the so-called sage. And essentially, as far as I can tell, the most common meaning of when they refer to a sage, the Taoists are actually talking about a superior ideal deportment of human consciousness or human beings. And essentially, what that means, the sage lives in harmony with the Tao, or at least attempts to. Lao Tzu says, In every movement, a man or woman of great virtue follows the way and the way only. Therefore, the Taoists believe we have a choice. Now, I've gotten into some debates with people because some people say, well, if everything's a Tao, then you can't be out of Tao. Everything is the Tao. And I said, no, that's not the Taoist belief. That is not the Taoist teaching. Taoists are very clear that we have a choice. You can live in accord with the Tao or not. And just like I would say in Jungian work, we can choose to live consciously in accord with the self or not. However, the choice is not without consequences. And often we know from practice that living an inauthentic life leads to emotional and often even physical suffering. Now, since the Tao has these two primary aspects, besides the Tao of the human, the Tao of earth and Tao of heaven, as I'm talking about, the task of the sage to be a whole person is to actually, you have to tune into both. So if I put that another way, the Tao of the human being is supposed to be the meeting place. Like our consciousness becomes the meeting place of the Tao of heaven and the Tao of earth. And they can be united through consciousness. So the role of the sage is to mediate and synthesize these two realms. Chuang Tzu probably means this when he says that the sage is one who follows two courses at the same time. In the I Ching, they say something similar. It says, looking upward, we contemplate the signs in the heavens. Looking down, we examine the lines in the earth. Now, there's a lot of ways we could understand that, and I'm just going to suggest one, is that maybe we have to, on a regular basis, consult both heaven and earth in our daily lives, and that might mean, for example, to be whole, you need to stay in touch with your dreams, your intuition, that sort of spiritual dimension. You have to stay in touch with your body. What is your body saying to you? How is it? What are its requirements? What is the physical environment saying to you? What is your relationship with nature? One of the interesting books that I read, that it's on that list, was one of the few books that was more of an actual experience of a scholar going to China and visiting monasteries and seeking out Taoist masters. It's John Blofield's book, The Secret and Sublime. And he said one of the more humorous stories is he went to a monastery and he found this sage, this monk that he knew knew something about the Tao. So he was following him around all day. And the Taoist monk, he was watering the garden, and then he went in the kitchen, chopped up some food, and then he was cleaning the kitchen, and then he was sweeping the floors, and you know, he's just doing his little daily tasks. So finally, Blofield is getting so frustrated with him. He says, I don't understand. You're doing all these things. When do you have time to cultivate your relationship with the Tao? And he said, this is what this all is. This is all the cultivation of my relationship with the Tao. You know, again, that Western idea, he thought he was going to go in his room and meditate, and that would be the cultivation of the Tao. But it isn't meant to be that way. It's daily life that can be in accord with the Tao. I think that's just another image of the sage. Here, indeed, meditating. Then I wanted to just show you that some of the other images, they're ones you would be familiar with, and we all dream about these things a lot. According to the Taoists, animals live in harmony with the Tao. And they're good models for us of how to live more instinctually and more naturally and more in sync with the moment. I think most of the time we dream about animals, of course, shows some relationship with that animal part of our psyche or our instincts, whether we're in good relationship with them or not. There's a funny little story. Here it is, yeah. this was the best picture I could find to go with this whole story, but this is from Chuang Tzu, and there's a walrus talking to a centipede. So the walrus says to the centipede, "I hop about on one leg and not very successfully. How do you manage all those legs that you have?" And so the centipede says, "Well, I don't manage them. My mechanism works naturally without my being conscious of the fact." Then the next part of the story is that the centipede talks to a snake. And the centipede says, "Well, with all my legs, I don't move as fast as you can. How is that?" And the snake replies, "One's natural mechanism is not a thing to be changed. What need have I for legs?" So again, extolling the virtue of nature without it figuring out how it works and why it is the way it is. There are a number of verses and stories that the Taoists use to suggest that infants and young children are also aligned with the Tao, living in complete harmony with their instincts and with basic nature. By the way, that actually is me. The one on the left. That was when I was in harmony with the Tao before I got out of Tao. Now, of course, like animals and children, we consider them to be unconscious. Even though they would be in accord with the Tao, they would not have what we consider to be desirable adult consciousness. But they would be acting more on impulse and without reflection, for better or worse. But children do serve as models for how to be more open, be more spontaneous, and be more instinctual. So I think that's why Lao Tzu in verse 28 advises us to become as a little child once more. Based on the same idea, Jung saw the symbol of the child as representing the possibility not only of an early developmental state, but of a higher level of consciousness that's at one with natural forces. So the child can represent wholeness that embraces the depths of nature. It's especially relevant for those of us who have developed a personality that's more unchildlike and artificial and disconnected from our roots. The child also reminds us of the value of having an open mind, a beginner's mind about the world, uncluttered with preconceived ideas, how to live, or who we're supposed to be. It's especially important if we want to be able to live in the Tao, which is ever-changing and requiring us to be in touch with the moment. The Taoists also recognize that there were two other groups of people that lived in accord with their instincts or in accord with the Tao. Again, so-called, you know, indigenous or so-called primitive peoples. Also, they felt like people who were insane, we would call insane or mentally ill or mentally retarded, actually were living more in accord with the Tao than the average citizens. Also, sometimes the Taoists refer to images of insane or drunk or, as I said, retarded individuals who live simply and in accord with the nature. And in the stories often live more successfully than the more intelligent, sober individual. I think it would be equivalent to what in our fairy tales is often the dumbling image, or like a modern day example would be like the movie Forrest Gump, who, despite his lesser intellectual capacity or IQ, led a quite interesting and successful life. From the perspective of modern depth psychology, we would say that these images are compensatory. They're balancing symbols. They're reminding us that to be complete doesn't just mean to develop our intellect to its highest capacity or to live an extremely rational life or productive life, but there's something else that life requires that means integrating the opposite. Another Taoist symbol that I found interesting and useful in understanding the concept of the Tao is that in most of the Taoist art depicts scenes of the natural world, like this cloud-topped peaks and rocky cliffs and shrouded valleys, pools. Typically, the human beings are very small in the pictures. You've all seen these kind of pictures. So that even the human structures are in there, but they're dwarfed by the immense beauty of the natural surroundings. So I looked at that like I might look at a dream. I felt like it was the Taoist depiction of a certain ideal they felt in terms of the role of the ego in terms of our larger nature. That consciousness, the ego, is only a small part of the natural scene, and that we need to learn to live in harmony with it and not to overwhelm it or overpower it, but to allow nature, our own nature, to basically unfold as it wanted to. And I think, again, the Taoist art teaches us that the ego's task is to live in harmony with the beauty and vastness of our own human nature. I also studied a practice of Taoist landscaping. This actually is a Zen garden, rock garden, but it's Taoist-inspired, I would say. The interesting thing about Taoist landscaping is that I think it's an image of how we can live in accord with the unconscious. So their idea was, the principal goal of the Taoist landscapers was to create what they called guided wildness. They felt like we could lend nature a hand by subtly modifying and improving upon nature's artistry. Great care was taken not to create an artificial scene in the garden, so that rocks and plants were arranged that would resemble an actual natural landscape, as it had been for thousands of years. However, they had a certain little rule that I think is really critical. They said that the landscaper could lend nature a hand, so if there was a shape or a texture that was already there, you could bring it out a little bit more. That was considered okay. So, like, if, for example, if there was a square shape of a rock, you couldn't round it. That would be against the Taoist principle. But if there was a relatively round one, you could round it some more. Same thing with shrubs. So if a shrub already resembled a stork, you could bring the stork out some more and mold it and cut it so that it would be a stork. But you couldn't just take any shrub and make it a stork. So John Blofield, the Taoist scholar, said the aim was to assist nature to do what it might under more favorable circumstances do by itself. I don't know if nature would make a real exact stork, but the principle I really like, because I thought, wait a minute, that's what we're doing with the unconscious. That's what we're trying to do in our Jungian work, is that we're trying to find the images and the patterns that are inherent in our nature that seem to want to come into consciousness, but can't quite do it without assistance. So these impulses and these images show up in our dreams or in our active imaginations. And, you can have unexamined dreams of things, whole series of dreams of beautiful things that never become conscious because it just doesn't, nature, just the psyche just can't do it by itself. Sometimes it does do it by itself. But Jungian work, I thought, was like this landscaping technique where we're trying to see the way nature wants to go, the way the psyche wants to go, what the Tao seems to be, and then we try to assist it. We try to help it along a little bit. Overall, you could say we're trying to find exactly what our own true nature wants to be, and then we try to facilitate it. We try to live it out. We try to find ways to integrate it and make it conscious. And there's a lot of ways we do that. To just take a simple example, if a person tended to be passive and not be active enough in their life or assertive enough, and let's say they have dreams maybe about really assertive or powerful people or animals, as compensatory images. It's something that's trying to happen. Like, if you look at it that way, like, okay, so there's a Tao of having more power, of having more assertiveness or aggressiveness. It's showing up in your dreams. And if you don't integrate that, you're out of the Tao. You're not in Tao. You don't integrate that new energy that's trying to come to consciousness. Well, so, but if we listen to that, and we work with those images, and we begin to think, well, yes, perhaps there's some ways I could integrate that and be more forceful in my life, and maybe we do some active imagination with the image that's in the dream, or we paint it, or we reflect on it, or even we go take an assertiveness class because the dream pushed us in that direction, or then we're doing the Taoist landscaping with our own psyche as the landscape. Well, Lao Tzu says that keeping to the main road, the Tao, is easy, but people like to get distracted. Well, I don't know if we like getting distracted or not, but I think there's no question that we do. We're all bombarded with distractions and temptations that can completely occupy and exhaust our minds or sensory apparatus or bodies, and basically make us completely unconscious of the Tao, the path. Some years ago, went to a seminar with James Hillman, and he, in this seminar, was emphasizing that he felt that our society was pathologically manic and that it was taking a devastating toll on our lives. And I think Jung, too, felt like that we would suffer if we didn't find our individual way. So to Jung, many depressions as well as other emotional and physical symptoms result from people adapting to the world or being distracted by the world and losing touch with the deeper meaning, the Tao. Living in accord with the Tao is all the more difficult when we're too tied to what other people think, what other people see in us, what other people say about us. We all fear disapproval and censure. Whoops. Maybe that's all I was going to say about that. Yes, that is what I'll say. Oh, no, there was something important I want to say. I really like this twist that this one translation of Lao Tzu put, that because I think so much, you know, we fear people's reactions when we're really trying to live our own way and whatever that is, and worry about, you know, I don't know how many times I said to my analyst, well, I can't do that. No one would like me. He'd just say, well, so. Or he'd say, well, why don't you try it and find out. Anyway, I like this one quote of Lao Tzu, because he turns it around. He says, if you are following the way of the Tao, you should listen to the laughter. Basically, if everyone likes you and thinks you're great, you're probably not following the Tao. So it turns it around. Anyway, this is how he says it. When the wise man learns the way, he tries to live by it. When the average man learns the way, he lives by only part of it. When the fool learns the way, he laughs at it. Yet, if the fool did not laugh at it, it would not be the way. Indeed, if you are seeking the way, listen for the laughter of fools. Whoops. Ah. I put this in here, and I won't go into this story, but this is a story I've written about in my publication. There's a story of a carpenter who's walking by a useless old oak tree, and he's explained to his apprentice why this tree is absolutely useless, that it's all twisted and distorted and the wood's all rotten, and they couldn't possibly use it, and they should completely ignore it. And then that night, the carpenter has a dream, which is interesting because that means the Taoists were also paying attention to their dreams. And the tree talks to him and says, who are you calling useless? And the tree goes on to explain that, hey, I'm being useless on purpose. Because if I were a useful tree, like these fruit trees and these beautiful oak trees and everything, don't you see what's happening to them? They're getting all the fruits being ripped off of them. All the limbs are being cut off. They're getting cut down by the world. And by being useless, I was able to grow to my complete and full fullness, my full stature. So the Taoists talk about the idea of being useless in a compensatory and an exaggerated way. I mean, even to the idea like, don't do anything to save the world. Don't shed a single hair to save the world. I think it's compensatory, particularly since the Confucianists were all telling people how to behave to take, you know, create harmony in the society and to make everybody happy. And the Taoists take the opposite position, says you don't have to do anything to try and save the world. Just be whole. That's your part. Just be whole. But anyway, I like that. That's my article on the usefulness of the useless based on that story of the oak tree. Well, we not only have to deal with the distractions and the coercions that I was talking about that we get from the collective, but we have to deal with our own egos, which may even be more of a problem. In most cases, the ego, it tends to be very narrow in vision and often rigid and inflexible. And Jung even says lazy. So it's the ego by nature is lazy. In other words, whatever the least course is, you just soon go along with it. This slide is of a collage that I made from a dream I had quite a long time ago. However, it does show me and my complete resistance to being in the Tao. It shows how rigid my ego could be. In the dream, the main character actually was a woman who resembled someone I knew, who I thought of as stubborn and hard-headed. And in the dream, she had traveled to the West Coast. You wouldn't know that from this, but she had traveled to the West Coast to go on a hike on the beach. And so she was dressed for this hike. You know, she had shorts or bathing suit on, a T-shirt, and suntan lotion and all that. And so she's hiking down to the beach in my dream, and it starts snowing. I grew up and I was born in Southern California. This was all taking place like there. We don't have snowstorms in Los Angeles. So there's a veritable blizzard going on at the beach in my dream. And she goes down and she starts like freezing and she will not go back. She will not go back. She will not postpone her hike. She will not go and get some better clothes on. She made up her mind. By golly, she was going on the hike. She didn't care if it was the beach and it was snowing. She was going to go anyway. So, you know, technically that's my anima, but it's still showing the lack of ability to be in the moment or adapt to the shifting of the Tao. In this case, it was showing a situation which there had been a dramatic shift in the Tao, which could have been accommodated by a more flexible attitude. But I was being shown this part of myself that was so stubborn that would just insist on going ahead doing whatever it had planned, even if the conditions had changed. I put this slide in here, and I couldn't find really a Chinese image that could represent what I wanted to, but I wanted to show the idea, and it doesn't show up so much in Taoism, but it's implied, and it's certainly a part of our Jungian way of looking at it, that the only way that you are going to be able to accommodate the kind of adaptability and that's required of living in accord with the Tao is to make a huge sacrifice. So this is an image of a skeleton holding a knife of sacrifice. It's actually from Mexico. But I've chosen it to symbolize the death or the self-sacrifice the ego must make to abide in the Tao. In my view, what the ego must sacrifice is not only its linearity and rigidity, but even more its sense of certainty and superiority. And in so doing, then, a more fluid ego is created, one that can be open to the changes that are needed to function fully and adaptively to live in accord with the Tao. There's a entertaining story that Chuang Tzu tells that kind of shows the kind of attitude that's required, the kind of sacrifice the ego should make. And I won't read it to you, it's rather long. But in essence, there's a young man who has some goals, some plans, and he wants to go carry out these plans. Very ambitious plans, very positive goals. And he goes and consults with the sage, and he tells the sage what all his plans are. And the sage says, well, it sounds pretty good, but are you sure that's going to work? And he goes, well, I have plan B. You want to hear plan B? And he goes, okay, he has another plan B all lined out. Sage says, well, you know, what if that doesn't work? He goes, well, I have plan C. So the sage says, hold it. You need to fast. And he says, well, I already fast. I fast, you know, every religious holiday. I fast just like I'm supposed to. And he says, no, you need to fast your mind. You have too many plans. He said, if you have so many plans, how will you listen to the Tao? So the idea being, and so he wasn't against him having plans, but you need to have an openness to the moment, to the Tao that would occur as you're proceeding. Like I was saying, like the fox going across the ice field, you have to be careful. You walk slowly. You might have to zigzag to get there. Once we've made this kind of ego sacrifice and created a humbler, more fluid ego, the task is to find the true center, what Jung calls the self, and live our lives from there as much as possible. For the Zen archer, this is a Zen archer picture, and Zen is a later development of Taoist ideas, the goal is not the bullseye of the target, but to be completely attuned to his or her center of being, and then and only then to release the arrow. There's actually a Taoist story that is similar to this. I just didn't have a picture of a butcher. But the Taoist image is of a butcher, this is from Chuang Tzu, that a butcher who is so centered in the Tao that he can take his knife and slice through the animal meat and get it exactly through the spaces between the bones and without the knife ever becoming dull. Yeah, Sharon? Yeah, I actually only have one more picture. But we're right on. Yeah. Just am ending with this last image, which is the image of flowing with water, which is one of the favorite images from Taoism. The wise sage is described as being like water or like melting ice, soft, pliable, able to flow with the natural course of the Tao. Chuang Tzu has a story of an old man jumping off a waterfall. And Confucius runs up to him and says, how did you do that? You should have been killed. And he says, well, it's rather simple. I don't have any way of doing it. I just plunge into the water with the whirl and I come out with the swirl. I accommodate myself to the water, not the water to me. Okay, I'll stop with that. And I'll take whatever questions we have. Well, you're the second person to mention Jackson Pollock already. I haven't studied those paintings.
Yeah,
all the lines.
This is a painter by the name of Bryce Martin.
Yeah. So I would imagine they're tapping into the same archetype that's being depicted. So this idea of a flow, of a movement like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, we might have more distractions and seductions like that, and the information age is really, I mean, it's something new that has never existed in ancient times. But I imagine still, you know, they had their own ego distractions and concerns and collective things going on. So in a way, your dilemma is the same as it would always be for the Taoists, would be, well, really, staying in tune with when to be on the computer and when to be off, that would be the whole thing. The Taoists wouldn't be against being on the computer. They would just say, you know, you have to do it at the right time, in the right way, when it was the Tao, and then stop. Like Alan Watts was talking about what it would look like for a Taoist to meditate. And he said, well, they would just meditate till it was time to stop. They wouldn't have a time, how long, they wouldn't know ahead of time.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.